It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, April the 29th, 2018. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and over at our friends, The Grueling Truth, which is part of the iHeart Media Network. And I think now here on Blog Talk Radio, there's some kind of announcement. I think you could even get this on Alexa, this show. So to find out more about that, I got a little email about that. But regardless, if you got an Alexa and you really want to listen to this on that, I'm sure you could figure it out. Hope everybody's doing well. Actually, a little double barrel action, to take a bullpen term out there today. You're getting this podcast from the Sunday afternoon, just before the Mets take on the Padres in the finale of their road trip, their finale of their three-game series out in San Diego. Not a banner road trip for the Mets. We had talked about a week ago about a test, kind of a first real tough test, and there's been some real brutal losses between the Atlanta loss, the loss on the rubber game in St. Louis with some bad fielding. The loss still from a couple of weeks ago when they blew the 6-1 lead to the Nationals back at Citi Field. So they've had three really tough losses in the last 10 days or so, probably three losses that will go down regardless of where this season goes as three of the worst, maybe not the three worst. Hopefully there's not too many worse, but when you get bad losses or tough losses, these will be up there. Maybe these will be the three that stick out, and that'd be good. That means that there's not a heck of a lot of other bad losses. But my commentary on the Mets will be more reserved for later tonight because I'll be co-hosting for the next 2 weeks on 5:40 a.m. WLIE with Rich Catino, our friend Rich Catino, who also works over at 98.7 ESPN, author of a book called The Press Box Revolution, coming out with a book about the 1969 Mets that's supposed to publish next year. So Rich and I will be doing all New York sports. That's the New York sports wrap. But I'm sure we'll get into the Mets. Real quick, today on this podcast, and I'm not going to go on long here in the intro, I have a pretty cool feature, I think, for you guys. Eric Sherman, author of a new book, Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond, will be joining me in just a few minutes. Eric has written a ton of baseball books, Kings of Queens, which is about the 86 Mets, Steve Blass book. He co-wrote the Mookie Wilson book. So Eric is very versed on book writing, baseball book writing, and diving into a topic, Davey Johnson, who it's been a long time since Davey was the Mets manager, and he had quite a few stops afterwards. And I think Davey's story with the Mets and then after is pretty fascinating. I always say that my experience with Davey Johnson, and I'll share this with Eric, was when I had a chance to talk to him during the 2010 Mets Hall of Fame ceremony. There was Frank Cashin was there, Davey was there, Dwight Gooden, Darryl Strawberry. That was the second year of Citi Field, and Mets were trying to, make Hall of Fame inductions, and those four were there. And I had a great conversation with the late Frank Cashin and Davey, and I always remember Davey because at that time there was a lot of talk. We're talking about, I don't want to say early sabermetric movement, but that was the beginning of the end of the Omar Minaya era, and sabermetrics was a big topic because the Mets weren't a really deep sabermetric team. And we chatted about pitch counts and pushing pitchers. And I said to Davey, I said, if you look at Doc Gooden's numbers early in his career, the amount of innings, the amount of bullets, for lack of a better word, that he used, 84, 85, leading into 86, yeah, I understand the drug use. Yes, I understand things happen. But Doc had shoulder problems. That was one of the reasons why he was out a good chunk of the 1989 season. Did that contribute to it? And Davey got very feisty, very angry with me. He's like, no, I had him on 125, 130 pitch count. We were aware of his usage. It wasn't just willy-nilly, so to speak. He said that Tommy Lasorda got mad at Davey because he had Doc on 125-130 pitch count, and Valenzuela found out about it, Fernando Valenzuela, and Lasorda would put him up at 150-160 pitches. Think about this. And I guess Lasorda looked at Tommy and said, look, you know, this is how I remember this story. Look, what about me? Why am I going 20-25, pitches more? Why are you not treating me this way? And Lasorda didn't believe in that. And Valenzuela had arm issues. And he, what was it, the screwball he was throwing? So, it was interesting, the fire in Davey's belly at that point. And you could tell he still had it. And then less than a year later, he was taking over as manager of the Washington Nationals and led them to a playoff and division title playoff berth. And subsequently, a tough five-game series loss, a tough loss they had to the Cardinals there in 2012. So we'll talk to Eric Sherman. We'll chat more about Davey Johnson after the break. And then as far as this current Mets team, and again, I'll get into it, and as we wrap up later, I'll give you all the details about WLIE. They're not a 12-2 team. They're not the 4-7 team that's played bad defense and really struggling offensively. They certainly fall in between. They're 16-9. I stick to what I said. I still think this is a team that is a 90-win team. Whether that's enough to win the division, I'm not sure. The Nationals are not off to a rocket and rolling start. Let's see how real and how ready the Phillies and the Braves are. Baseball's a long season. We're not even at May 1st. And, to be 25 games in, it's still very much, like I said, you could go 50, 60, 70, 80 games before you really get a feel in the era of the second wild card of a team. But we'll get more into that on the WLIE broadcast later. Right now, let's take a quick break. When I return, Eric Sherman. You can check out Eric on Twitter at ShermBaseball, and you can also get him on his website, EricShermanBaseball.com. So we'll take a quick break. When we return, Eric Sherman, author of the book Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond, and he'll join us right after this.
Even Davey Johnson, manager of the Mets, has days when his pitcher and his stomach block.
Can't believe he walks the leadoff batter.
Which is why Davey keeps Rolaids nearby. Rolaids Antacid is serious medicine that consumes all the acid required to bring millions 100% relief.
Hope he doesn't throw the fastball.
And on days filled with errors and frankfurters, Rolaids relief is what's needed most.
I should have gone into golf.
Get serious relief. Get Rolaids.
We're back, and joining me is author of the new book, Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond, Eric Sherman. You could check out Eric on Twitter at ShermBaseball, and you guys probably know him. You probably have read his books on Mookie Wilson and Glenn Burke. I think he did a book on Steve Blass, so he knows a little thing about baseball. Eric, welcome to the program. How you doing here on this weekend morning? How's everything?
Well, Mike, I'm doing fantastic. Crazy busy with several book projects. The one right now with Davey Johnson, which is going terrifically well. But I must say, before we start, I was just taken back in time with that intro, with the organ music at Shea Stadium. I mean, it took me back to 1973 or 74 when I'd go to games and just before the Mets took the field. That was the organ music that you used to hear.
Yeah, and it's funny. I'm glad you said that because a few other guests that Matt Cerrone on recently said the same thing, so I appreciate that. Well, your book is taking people back to a fun time in Mets baseball, the 80s, with Davey Johnson. But Davey's an interesting character, Eric, and when I saw the book coming out, I think I saw it on Amazon that it was a May launch, 6-7 months ago, something like that. I've had a chance to meet Davey once in a journalistic setting. It was when he was being inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame, and I had a chance to interact with him. I think that's 2010. Frank Cashin was there. Doc and Darryl were there. And I remember we were just talking, and you could still see the fire in Davey at that point. Now, that's before he took over the Nationals. And it was funny. I questioned him. I said, Davey, I just said, I'm curious. Forget the drugs and everything with Doc. Do you ever think – that because at that time pitch counts and everything were becoming a big deal. Back at Doc's usage early in his career, I go, he had some heavy usage. Do you think that had something to do with it? Oh, boy, he snapped back at me. He had all the reasons, the data, all the stuff that went on. He talked about how Lasorda was mad at him because Doc told Venezuela about how many pitches he did. And I said to myself, the guy still got fired. Sure enough, he starts managing again about a year later. So I'm sure you got that experience when you had a chance to interact with Davey for this project.
I did. I know exactly what you're talking about. He still has the fire today, for sure. And he still has very, very strong opinions and convictions about the way that he managed. Yeah, what you refer to, I think he told reporters that when someone had a high pitch count, he was being Lasorded because Tommy Lasorda used to have Fernando Valenzuela throw 150, 160 pitches, and so he would use the term Lasorded. But yeah, he still has the fire, he doesn't believe that he burned Doc out. In fact, I think if you go back to the early 80s, ball clubs really used their pitchers a lot differently than today, and they conditioned them. And Davey told me that, it's fine to disagree with him, but he'll give you 10 reasons every single time for why he did what he did. Another funny Davey quote, he's really a very entertaining guy. He said, I loved it when my coaches disagreed with me. I would have preferred that. I got that wrong. My coaches didn't always agree with me, and that was fine. But if they did agree with me, then I think they were a smart son of a gun. So,
yeah, he wasn't short on confidence. But before we get to the managerial ride, which I'm sure it sounds like looking at some of my notes here, you found out some really interesting things. But there's Davey Johnson, the ball player, and I don't know if everybody really talks about Davey Johnson, the ball player. We all know he made the last out in the '69 World Series. Really solid second baseman, played in Japan, had a big year with the Atlanta Braves in the 70s. And, as a player in with those Orioles teams, is that how he became, I guess, formed as a manager? What does he remember most? What are some of the things that came out for Davey Johnson, the player for the Orioles and the Braves and so on?
Well, clearly, Earl Weaver had a tremendous influence on him. Earl came up to manage in 68, and Davey's first year was 66. And so Davey was just kind of coming into his own at that point as a star second baseman. And Earl actually managed him in the minor leagues as well. So that was probably his biggest managerial influence early on. However, Davey had his own convictions even back then. He was really the first one to bring sabermetrics into baseball. And he used a computer, an old IBM computer, and he put every single type of game scenario into that computer with the Orioles lineup for the 1968 season to prove a point to Earl that he should be batting second instead of sixth or seventh. And Earl tossed that data into the trash. But he was, I would say, part his own man and part what he took in from Earl Weaver, who he sat next to on the bench pretty much every game and picked his brain on things. But just one quick story. In 1966, when Frank Robinson was his teammate and Frank won the Triple Crown that year, Frank was slumping at one point in the season, and Davey was just a rookie, and he picked up something during batting practice that Frank was doing a little bit wrong, and he pointed it out to Frank, and Frank went on like a 12-for-19 tear on his way to the Triple Crown. That's unheard of, especially then for a rookie to go up to a superstar like that and actually give him some advice. Uh, and And he did. And but that was the type of guy that Davey was, even back in his early 20s.
He was actually, you know, I'm looking at his numbers here on Baseball Reference. You talk about sabermetrics. He was an on-base guy at his peak. He's a guy who's going to get on base about 35% of the time. He had power. He was a gold glove second baseman. I didn't see enough of him to play to know, you know, defensive runs saved and all that stuff. But, you know, a neat little player. I think sometimes gets underrated. And then you have, and I'm sure he talked about it because it's been, it's always a conversation in trivia and whatnot. He has that 43 home run season with the Braves in 1973, a second baseman record. And if it was today, Eric, or maybe not today, but prior to testing, we probably would all have these steroid accusations. He goes from 18 home runs as a high, 5 home runs, and then all of a sudden 43. Never had that many before in his life. Out of his 136 homers in his career, 43 happened in one season. What did he talk about that? Because that's you know, that's some jump. That's some season playing for the Braves in 1973.
Yeah, I mean, if that were today, I think people would have just assumed that he was on PEDs, right? That significant of a jump. Well, what actually happened was, you know, there weren't PEDs in the game then, so that's not what it was. What it was, the Orioles hammered into him. It really was Darryl Johnson, who went on to manage the Red Sox to the pennant in 1975. Well, he was working with the Orioles then, and he would hammer into the Orioles hitters to hit the Orioles way, which was a lot of, you know, the way that Brooks Robinson used to hit. So it's kind of like an inside-out swing, drive the ball hard the other way. I guess one you'd remember is when Brooks Robinson hit that BB to right field in the 69 series that Ron Swoboda caught. I mean, it was kind of to hit like that. And when Davey got out of there, he went to Atlanta and he started pulling the ball. And, you know, he started playing with guys like Hank Aaron and so forth. And he also was playing hurt for several years after a collision at home plate, actually two collisions at home plate, during, I want to say, the 71 season. And the Orioles couldn't really diagnose what the problem was in his shoulder. And the Braves medical staff were able to figure it out. And they basically cured him of that injury that he had had. And so it was those two factors, going back to pulling the ball and getting healthy again in his shoulder, that really helped him.
Eric Sherman is with me, author of the book Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. You get it now. I'm over on Amazon. You get it in hardcover. You get it in Kindle. And I'm sure if you're a Mets fan, I think Davey's the one part of that 80s run that I think sometimes we overlook a little bit. You talk about Doc and Darryl and the players and Game 6 and what happened after. I think Davey sometimes gets overlooked. So, you know, Davey goes to Japan, he ends up his career, and then he becomes a manager. Did he talk about that transition from player to manager and getting involved with the Mets, and he was managing in their minor league system? It's 1978 is his last year, and by 84, he's a big league manager. Not unheard of, but that's pretty quick back in those days. You had to really put your time in. You had to pay your dues back then. It wasn't like today where you jump from player to front office to dugout. They weren't as progressive back then.
No, it was a different world. He went to manage this team called the Miami Amigos. It was it was a professional team. I don't think they were affiliated with any ball club, but that's where he cut his teeth in managing, and he had a winning percentage of like 800. He did extremely well, and then the league folded. And then he went into the Mets organization and worked his way up and really got to know the minor league system and what the Mets had very, very well. And he was managing Doc when he was just a kid, you know, like 17 years old. He managed Darryl Strawberry, of course. And, I mean, Davey really knew what the heck the Mets had in that minor league system. Lenny Dykstra was another one, and Wally Backman, who wasn't the most talented second baseman, but he just loved the way that he played. So really, he knew what they had. And so by the time he came up to manage in 84, he was the perfect pilot for that ball club. He brought up Dwight Gooden a year before Frank Cashin wanted him up. And, you know, his relationship with Frank is a whole other thing, which he really gets into in the book. I mean, Mets fans will devour that. That very odd relationship he had with Frank. Let's just say that for now.
That's true. I'm with me, Eric Sherman, author of the book, the new David Johnson book out there. You probably have read his work, King of Queens, the Mookie Wilson book, a ton of others. So he's a guy that you want to talk baseball with. What's interesting is that, you know, and I go back to the old Pat Riley innocent climb and how teams are, you know, have that arc. It was perfect the way it happened with Davey. Like you said, he was in the minor league system. He gets a chance to see these guys. He gets to the big leagues. He changes the culture immediately. And you see the whole arc with this team all the way to 1990 when things start to taper off. And, you know, you mentioned Frank Cashin. The one criticism I remember back then of Davey, and maybe this was coming out or leaked through the media with the front office, was that he was known as a player's manager. And at some point, they felt, I guess the media or maybe even the fans felt, that because he was so laid back, the players didn't push themselves after they had success after 1986. And that's how things kind of went awry. You have obviously the off-the-field stuff, but – you know, this is a team that started to, you know, take time off during the season, feel that it was good enough to put it together whenever they wanted, which they were. And at times some feel that that's where maybe they left, I guess, stuff on the table. Did Davey talk about that, about this club, and Frank Cashin, because that's a separate conversation we'll have, about where he could have maybe been a little different with them, especially as they got new players like Greg Jeffries and there was a transition after 87, 88, where they were trying to put guys like Magadan and Jeffries, and there was the Hernandez-Carter guys that were on the way out.
Well, he let them be men. How can you possibly, watch these guys after they leave the ballpark? You can't watch them 24/7. I think as their manager, though, Davey did have regrets over what happened. I don't think he would have done a whole lot differently, but as their manager, he takes some of the blame for what happened with Doc and Darryl. Now, as far as what he accomplished with the club, he averaged 96 wins a season in his tenure with the Mets over seven years. And he'll be the first to tell you that after 96, they just weren't the same team. So, you know, you hear a lot how, that 80, did I say 96? I meant to say 86.
86.
After 86, you know, they didn't win another World Series. Now, if it were today, they would have made the wild card with that club, a wild card or a division championship. They would have made the playoffs five years in a row, I believe. But after 86, they just weren't the same ball club. He never wanted Cashin to trade Kevin Mitchell, who Cashin believed was a bad influence on Doc and Darryl, which nothing could have been further from the truth. Mitchell didn't, drink. He didn't smoke. I mean, but because he came from a difficult upbringing, a dangerous neighborhood, he felt that he was a bad influence on Doc and Darryl, but he also called Davey called Kevin Mitchell the greatest pure hitter he's ever seen. So that changed the dynamic a lot, because Kevin Mitchell was the enforcer on that ball club. The 86 club had four bench clearing brawls, and Mitch and Ray Knight, who they also didn't re-sign the following year, were the enforcers on that team. So they just didn't have that swagger after 86 that they had. I mean, they didn't just beat up on teams, they intimidated them in 86, and they lost that intimidation factor altogether. And that's what Davey explains, that, you know, they just weren't the same ball club. And then, of course, later on, they lose Aguilera, they lose Dykstra, they lose McDowell. And they get players in exchange that they really didn't need. You know, like they would get Frank Viola in 89, and they already had five starting pitchers. So there was a disconnect after 86 with Frank Cashin, and that led to a lot of friction between the two.
And I read also that Davey defended his decision to leave Doc in that infamous game four in 1988. It was funny, the late Gary Carter and I were talking when he was managing the Ducks, and I said, Gary, you know, I know this is ancient history, but what about that scenario? And he looked at me, smiled, he goes, I wasn't the manager. Because he was a manager then, because I was trying to get him to see the parallels, and especially with bullpen management today, understanding 1988 was the beginning of that. But he trusted his – it was interesting. It sounds like Davey trusted Doc. He trusted his players. By that time, they had won a championship. Doc was the – you know, he was Dr. K. If you really go back and look at the stats, he really wasn't Dr. K anymore by that time. But back then, he was Dr. K. And who would have thought Mike Socia would hit a home run? But he defends that decision. Now, it sounds like throughout the conversations, Eric, he doesn't really go back and have a lot of regrets. He felt that the process was good at every juncture. And that specifically to me would be one I would think he would look back and go, yeah, I should have brought in my closer. You know, a guy that turned out to be a pretty good closer for other teams as well.
Yeah, no way. In fact, he thought they had everything set up perfectly. I think it was John Shelby that kept fouling balls off prior to Socia. He thought that Doc had Shelby struck out. I think it was Shelby. And he ended up walking him. And that brought up Socia, who had all of, I think, four home runs that year. And he had an anemic batting average against Doc. And Doc gave him a pitch to hit. And yeah, I mean, the book I did with Mookie and you know, I did Queens with pretty much all the other regular players and unique personalities from that 86 team. They all felt that Davey should have brought in Randy Myers in that situation. I mean, Myers was having a terrific season, you know, and it would have been a lefty against a lefty. And Davey had so much faith in Doc Gooden. You know, he had him as a 17-year-old in the minors, and he just had just tremendous respect for Doc's abilities. And back in those days, you know, guys were finishing games more. Of course, in that postseason, Oral Hershiser, I think he pitched till his arm dropped off. You know, I mean, it was just a different time, and he had all the faith in the world in Gooden.
Absolutely. And, you know, it was interesting, too, looking at 86. It was a little more personal for Davey beating John McNamara. I didn't realize that.
It was, yeah. I went all the way back to the minor leagues. And you know, this is like one of the stories in the book that I think may have surprised me the most. So in the minor leagues, McNamara was a catcher and I guess he called for a pitch and hits Davey right in the nose and breaks his nose. It was just awful. And so fast forward like 23 years or 24 years, whatever it was, when Mookie hits the ball that goes through Buckner's legs and, you know, Davey's running out on the field as Ray Knight crosses home plate. What do you think the first thing he thought of was? He thought about getting revenge. He had finally gotten revenge on John McNamara. I mean, I couldn't believe that, you know, that after all those years, that's what he thinks of, you know, and, you know, instead of, well, you know, what an unbelievable comeback. I mean, maybe the greatest comeback in World Series history. And his first thought that popped into his head was that he had finally gotten even with John McNamara.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great. Eric Sherman, author of the new Davey Johnson book, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. You mentioned earlier Frank Cashin, and that to me is not a surprising thing that they didn't get along. But that's really a theme of the Mets years. There's so much more to it. We'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, to Davey, I should say, in his managerial career. And it is a bit of a trend where he pretty much burns out his bridges. He's almost like Mike Keenan in a way after that with the Rangers. He comes in, he has success, and he burns bridges with the front office. But so Frank Cashin and Davey, you know, Frank gives Davey the job. They win a championship together. It was not as peaches and cream as you would think with the success they had. And really, it sounds like it was a big part, not maybe as much as the players not performing or the issues off the field, but a very big part of why this team did not win more or fall apart maybe a little bit earlier than, you know, they really probably should have.
Yeah, well, the surprising thing about Frank and Davey was that they worked together, you could say, in Baltimore, starting in, I think, 1969. Frank was in the front office. Frank was a sports writer going way, way back. That's why he always wore bow ties, because those were the days when, you know, you didn't want to get newspaper print on your ties. So a lot of people in that industry wore bow ties, but they went back to the late 60s together with Baltimore in the Orioles halcyon days. And now they're in New York together, and Cashin hires Davey. So you would have thought that the two of them would have had, you know, this terrific relationship. And I think they may have, I wouldn't call it terrific, but I think that they had a good relationship in the beginning. And certainly, you know, they turned the club around in 84 from, you know, a club that only won 60-plus games to a team that won 90. And it was probably the most fun year if you're a Mets fan. Then in 85, they had a terrific team that in most other years they would have won the division. And then in 86, you know, they 108 wins and a world championship. But yeah, they after 86, Frank started making decisions really without Davey's blessing. And then he brought on Al Harrison and McIlvain. And it was like Davey calls it the triumvirate. You know, I kind of think of it more as a three-headed monster. And these guys were making the shots. They were calling the shots on player personnel. And it wasn't always like that. You know, going into the 86 season and building that team, Davey felt that Wally Backman wasn't good from the right side of the plate. So he asked Frank to go get him Tim Tuffle, and he got him. You know, he felt that Hojo wasn't as good from the right side as the left side, so he went out and got Ray Knight. So they worked well together, I think, in the beginning, but after 86, for whatever reason, maybe it was Frank's envy of Davey's success, a little bit of jealousy there, which is very possible, because, you know, back in those days, general managers generally didn't get the publicity that the managers got. Now, of course, you know, with the Theo Epsteins of the world, general managers have almost become the face of organizations. But it was very, very different then. And, and moving a little further into his career, I'm sure he'll ask me about it, you know, with Peter Angelos and Marge Schott. I think they were envious of the way that Davey turned clubs around, and felt maybe Davey was getting too much credit, and there was some resentment there.
Yeah, I mean, he gets fired in 1990. Buddy Harrelson takes over. That team plays well after Davey left. They probably would have gotten hot with Davey there, though. If things were as bad as they were with Frank Cashin, you know, you have to wonder, that could be, you know, a bit of a distraction. You know, then he sits out a little bit, and you're right. You know, his next two stomps are with clubs. One, the Reds, that have had a very mercurial owner. I think that's a nice way of saying it. And yeah, then Peter Angelos, who could be to this day one of the most meddlesome, toxic environments that he's created from people that have worked for him there. You know, whether it's, you know, I don't know if it's ill intention, it just might be the way he is. And that should be a dream job. You know, here's the former Oriole coming on and taking over, yep, the Orioles at a time where they were actually spending dollar for dollar with the Yankees. You know, he almost beat, should have probably beaten the Yankees. He got some bad luck in 96. They had one of the best teams in baseball in 97. You know, benches Cal Ripken. I mean, think about that. That's crazy. But in both stops, it's very short-lived. Success, very short-lived with some odd scenarios there. You know, what were his memories on that? What stands out there? Because that's almost a decade before he gets to the Dodgers where, you know, he probably should have lasted longer with either one of those clubs. But it was almost like he came, he saw, and he left before he even got a chance to really, you know, get the seat warm, so to speak.
Well, Marge Schott, was the owner of the Reds at that time, was, she was just crazy. The Reds were going through a slump at one point, and she took the hair from her deceased dog, Shotzi One, and started rubbing it on Davey for good luck before a game. I mean, there are all kinds of stories about Marge in this book, and you know, I know like 40% of the book deals with Davey's Mets years, but I would have to say that his days with the Orioles and the Reds, I mean, those stories are just as interesting and peculiar in some ways. Marge Schott, I think, I mean, there's so much I could say here. She disapproved of Davey living with a woman that he wasn't married to, even though and Davey would go on to marry her. He's still married to her today. His current wife, Susan, had a special needs son who was deaf and blind. And yet she was playing all high and mighty over him. And so it seemed like no matter what Davey did with the Reds at that time, how much success he had, his days were numbered. And she made Ray Knight a co-manager. And so almost no matter what Davey did, and he accomplished a lot in a very short period of time with the Reds, Ray Knight was going to take over for him. And once Ray Knight did, the Reds kind of went back down into the doldrums again. So he goes to Baltimore, his dream job. You're right. He used to play for the Orioles. He won 4 pennants with them. I mean, he was a local hero. He goes back, and he has a tremendous degree of success in a very short period of time. He really turned that ball club around. You know, you could say the Orioles were just as talented as the Yankees at that point. And, I guess the downfall began when he fined Roberto Alomar, and he recommended that, you know, the money go to his wife's charity. His wife had raised tens of thousands of dollars for Baltimore area charities. I know her very, very well. She's a terrific individual. I mean, just a great, great person. And so once Angelo's brought Davey's wife into it, he's like, I'm out of here. And the irony is that on the day that Davey was named manager of the year in 97, he resigned from his job. He basically said, thank you for the manager of the year award, I quit. And that's the name of that chapter. But and Angelo's, he still to this day, I think, is pretty hot about him.
And does he look at the Dodgers as maybe a mistake where it's an iconic franchise? Fox, the corporate guys just took it over. They had traded Piazza. They had some talent. It was a weird transitional time for the Dodgers there because of the Fox situation. And again, short situation, one bad year, one good year. What is he, you know, before you, because the Nationals thing is the one that really fascinates me because of the how long the layoff was. But you'd be remiss if you just glazed over the Dodgers, but I think a lot of people do. They forget Davey managed the Dodgers for a couple of years.
It's interesting. I just did an interview yesterday, and the interviewer asked me the same thing or made the statement, the same statement, that people often forget that J.D. was the manager of the Dodgers. It's almost like people forget that Babe Ruth was involved with the Dodgers as well. You know, when you think of these guys, you just don't think of them as Dodgers. But Davey grew up a Dodgers fan. So again, like this was another example of a stop that he had hoped would be his last stop. You know, and going back to the Reds, his current wife is from Cincinnati. So that was a job that he wanted, you know, to stay at too. So yeah, the Dodgers, it was a somewhat of a toxic situation. You know, he didn't work well with Kevin Malone, they were making moves that, that, you know, he didn't really give his blessing to either. And he, you know, the Dodgers really, really didn't have much of a farm system. He improved the club, but not to the same level that he had improved, the Mets, the Reds and the Orioles. But yeah, that was a strange stop. But, you know, by the end of the 2 years, I don't think his heart was really in it. He had a very sick daughter that he wanted ultimately to get back to Florida to be with. You know, his daughter ultimately would succumb to schizophrenia. She died of toxic shock. That's a very sad story. So I think in a way he was glad that he went back to Florida and left the Dodgers at that time in his life. So there wasn't the remorse of leaving that club, you know, like he had leaving the Mets and certainly the Orioles.
And yeah, I mean, Davey, I think especially when I had talked to him in 2010, I think he had had some of his own health issues. He was gone for a while. He was consulting for the Nationals. And now you fast forward. Yeah, the 90s seems like the modern era, Eric, because I grew up watching baseball in the 90s. But compared to today, it's really not. It's kind of that in between the, you know, the old way of baseball that, you know, you mentioned the 70s and the Oregon that you watched maybe growing up in the, you know, the 70s, 80s. And, you know, I'm a 90s guy. And then he starts managing the Nationals and Bryce Harper in this, you know, similar to the Mets in 84, an up-and-coming team that was just so bad for a while. And you would think after a decade the fire would be gone. I explained the story about how I still saw it. Was he planning on getting back into the sauce here? Or was that something that, because he was a consultant and they were in a position they needed somebody, it was like, oh, let's give this a try? Because I would never have guessed, Davey, after all that time off, even after talking to him in 2010, seeing the fire, that a team would hire him, much less that he would want to manage.
Well, yeah, I mean, he never intended to return. I mean, he had an open mind. In those in-between years, he had managed the U.S. Olympic team. I mean, he did his share of managing. He managed in the World Cup. So he still had his hand in it, but you make the comparison of that young Washington Nationals team with the team he had in 84 at the Mets. I mean, how much alike was the scenario of having Strasburg and Harper with Gooden and Strawberry? I mean, it was the same thing. You know, the best young pitcher and the best young hitter in the game in both those scenarios. So now he has it again. But no, he was getting ready to go on a long trip with his wife, and they were going to Alaska, I believe. And they put that on hold, and he went back to manage. And it was such a similar situation to the 84 Mets, but he still had the fire. You know, he, like I said, you know, he managed a bunch of young teams in the interim between the Dodgers and the Nationals, not a major league situation, but Olympics, World Cup. And so he had his hand in it. And, you know, he's still, a day doesn't go by when Davey doesn't watch a game on TV. He loves the game. And you haven't truly watched a major league game until you've watched one with Davey Johnson. He just, he sees things that the average fan or average observer of the game just doesn't see. He's a brilliant baseball guy. So it was no surprise to me that he succeeded in Washington after all those years.
Yeah, and then they had that. It's I don't know if he wanted to leave. You can answer that. It's a weird team. They have good year, kind of down year. They lose to the Mets in 2015. They were struggling under Davey in 2013. Then they got hot late, and they couldn't make up the ground. You wonder, they went to Matt Williams. You wonder if they had just kept Davey around, he might have had a chance. Again, it's who knows, to do some different things with Davey, because you saw how Dusty Baker was able to maybe connect a little better with that squad than Matt Williams. You know, was it truncated in Davey's mind? You know, it's interesting because it's like things were getting going and then it's over, and now I guess that's it for him. I mean, I don't imagine I see Davey Johnson managing a ball club going forward.
It was a huge mistake that the Nationals made. Davey had them on the right track. You know, he had a very high salary, and it could have been that the Nationals thought, well, we can win without him, which was an ongoing theme, you know, winning without him. So he builds these teams up and gets them on the cusp of the championship, and then these teams, for whatever reason, felt that they could win without him. And Matt Williams came a lot cheaper. Davey at the time was around 70 years old, and it's, you know, like that old famous quote from Casey Stengel after he got fired after the 1960 World Series. He said, you know, the biggest mistake that I made was turning 70. You know, I'll never make the mistake of turning 70 again. That's what he said.
Right.
And so it was a very similar thing, I think, with Davey. You know, and again, it's just, there's some envy there, Davey getting the credit. And, it just seemed to be something that went on and on and on throughout his managerial career. But his winning percentage, I mean, it was nearly 600. I mean, he probably should be in the Hall of Fame just based on his managing alone. I mean, if you look at his contemporaries that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, I guess the best example would be Whitey Herzog. You know, he consistently was more successful than Whitey Herzog. And, you know, they both won one World Series. And but for whatever reason, I don't understand that at all, because, you know, it wasn't like he didn't get along with the media. I mean, he was a media darling. So I just don't think that he got the credit that he deserved for his body of work as a manager. And then you couple that with what he did as a player, you know, the all-time single season home run record is for second baseman, and being on four pennant winning teams and two world championship teams as a player, and bringing sabermetrics to the game, and really having a Gumpian career, being in the same lineup when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record, and then 2 years later being in the same lineup when Sadahara Oh surpassed Babe Ruth's home run record. I mean, you could just go on and on. I mean, he is one of the most iconic baseball lives of anyone that's ever played the game.
A couple of things before we wrap up. The game changed a lot. Did Davey change as a manager as he became older? I mean, you think about when he started in 84 versus the game in 1990 versus the game in 1999 versus the game in 2012, 2013. That's a long – I mean, I guess maybe that would be the same if he managed from 1950 to 1970, but I don't know about that. I think that's a very transitional time in baseball when it has – where the players, the money, the way the game is looked at and managed. It's interesting. Did he ever intimate to you whether he changed, whether it be personnel-wise and how he interacted, or, you know, how he went about his business and managed the team?
I don't think he changed one bit. I don't think he felt like he needed to. Now, has the game changed? Sure. I mean, you look at how closers are used today. You know, I think that's the biggest difference. Closers today maybe go one inning, maybe one hitter, you know, but let's just say they go one inning. I mean, Davey comes from the time when, you know, you didn't worry about that. You know, I mean, if you had a closer and the game was on the line in the seventh inning or the eighth inning, you know, you brought in your closer. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't adhere to going with lefties and righties, but he wanted to instill confidence in his relief pitchers. So he didn't use his relievers in a situation where, okay, well, I have a lefty and a righty coming up, so I'm going to use my lefty out of the bullpen against the lefty, then I'm going to go to the bullpen no matter what and bring in the righty. He wasn't like that. He believed that if he worked that way, then it would take the confidence away from his relievers. He wanted to instill confidence in his pitchers. So he wasn't going to use seven or eight pitchers in a game like they do today. He was going to use a Doug Sisk or a Roger McDowell against other, you know, against left-handed hitters. You know, he wasn't automatically going to be a push-button manager and make the pitching change, you know, to match up lefties and lefties and righties with righties. So I get asked a lot, how would he do today? I don't know if he would really like managing in today's game. I mean, it would really have to be on his terms. It would almost have to be a situation like Francona has in Cleveland, where they truly let Francona manage. But today, general managers are just so much more involved in not just personnel moves, but with what happens on the field. And I don't think that would sit very well with Davey.
Eric, for you, what you went into this project, you've done a ton of projects with in baseball with different characters, different players. Did you walk away with one thing that you learned about Davey Johnson that you did not, I guess, expect or know? Maybe that's a loaded question, but what is that one thing you walked away after this project that you said, wow, that was really interesting? There's so many, I know, but is there one thing that stands out? Because this is a multi-layered guy, really interesting conversation and stuff, because no one's really dived into Davey before.
No. And I think that's the reason why I wanted to take on the book project. After I wrote Kings of Queens, I said to myself that I didn't want to be a co-author anymore. I just wanted to write books on my own. But Davey wrote the foreword for Kings of Queens, Life Beyond Baseball with the 86 Mets, and he loved the book. And he said basically that I was the one, that I was the one that he wanted to do his memoir with. And he's one of those handful of guys that I would be like, yeah, love to co-author a book with Davey Johnson, because there were so many questions that I had. Why he did jump from team to team as a manager, you know, why teams wouldn't covet having a mind like that in the dugout. But the thing that surprised me the most wasn't so much a specific example, but more the kind of person that he is. Everyone thinks he's cocky and full of swagger and full of himself. That's really not the case. On a personal level, he's actually, believe it or not, a pretty humble guy. Now, don't confuse being humble with a lack of confidence. I mean, he has tremendous confidence in his ability, and not just on the field, but off. You know, he's made much more money in real estate than he ever made in baseball. But I'll give you a quick example, actually. We were sitting having lunch at a hotel in Queens before he had to catch a flight. And a couple of the chefs, like, they came out and they asked to have their picture taken with Davey. And our server, a young woman, you know, she apologized. She said, I'm really sorry. Are you famous? And Davey goes, well, you know, I had something to do with that team that plays across the street. and he goes, but this is the guy that's famous, Eric Sherman. He's a famous author. He completely moved the attention, the spotlight away from him onto me. You know, he and, you know, I mean, I'm not a famous author, right? but he just you know, skewed the attention away from himself. And in the 3 years that I've known him, I mean, he does that consistently. He's a pretty regular guy. And, you know, his goal throughout his whole career was pleasing the people that he worked for. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, they just didn't appreciate what he was doing.
Hey, so Eric Sherman Baseball is the website. Obviously, Mets fans, King of Queens, the Mookie Wilson book. You've done a ton of things that they can see over at your website. You got an interesting project coming up. I don't know if you want to tease that you're working on that
sure.
is not Mets related but connected. Before we, as we wrap up here, give everybody a couple things. What you know, what's going on with you? Where they could find this book? Yeah. Things you want to promote? I really find the topic fascinating, David John, today. I've always thought, you know, someone should write a David Johnson book, and when it happens, you know, it's really fascinating. Interesting journey for sure. What else is going on? Let the listeners know what else is going on.
Well, first, the David Johnson book, you can pick it up wherever books are sold. I know the publication date is May 15th, but I know that the book is already out there and it's available. My website is ericshermanbaseball.com. I'm actually working on two other projects right now. I just finished a manuscript with Art Shamsky, a book on the 69 Mets. So that will come out March 1st, 2019, which will coincide with the 50th anniversary of the Mets, of the Miracle Mets championship season. We interviewed pretty much every living player, anyone that was involved in the 69 Mets organization at the time. I'm very excited about that. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. Real quickly on that, we traveled out to California with Jerry Kuzman, Ron Swoboda, and Buddy Harrelson, and paid a visit to Tom Seaver. The stories in this book are just priceless. But I'm also working on a project now, which I'm working on the manuscript for. It's on the 86 Red Sox. So it's Kings of Queens, only with the key and more intriguing members of the 86 Red Sox. So, you know, your Roger Clemens, your Dwight Evans, your Wade Boggses, your oil can boys, and even other guys like Steve Lyons. I'm very excited about that book because, Kings of Queens did really, really well with those stories about, you know, those 86 Mets. But this 86 Red Sox, you know, the other side of that story and what they're doing today and some of the trials and tribulations that they've had, I'm very excited about that as well. And that'll probably come out late next year. So I've had this stream of books of late. So keeping myself very busy, Mike.
Well, listen, you've been very generous on a week, and I told you 20 minutes and we're almost on 45:50. So I'm going to let you go, but it's been a pleasure. I'm looking forward to hearing more about your projects. I do enjoy your work and enjoy yourself. Enjoy watching baseball this summer, and I'm sure we'll catch up. And thank you again so much. All righty.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. I would love to come back one day.
You got it. Eric Sherman, Eric Sherman Baseball on Twitter, at Sherman Baseball on Twitter. Interesting stuff. Like I said, you know, it's interesting. I was going to have him on for, you know, 15, 20-minute hit on the book about David Johnson. We got into a whole conversation and what have you. Hey, let's take a quick break. When we return, we'll wrap up. I'll talk to you about my WLIE appearance, a couple of quick thoughts, and then we'll move on. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time at our buddies over at MetsMerizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet, at Mike Silva Media, and you can get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. Let's wrap up with final thoughts right after this.
Hey, Mets fans, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you're looking for the best, unbiased, and independent coverage of the New York Mets, then look no further than MetsMerizedOnline.com. Metsmerized Online is the go-to place for comprehensive Mets coverage, including exclusive interviews, daily original articles, great weekly features, in-depth analysis, minor league reports, game-by-game breakdowns, and so much more. Find out why thousands of fans turn to Metsmerized Online every day to get the latest news and opinions about the Mets. Coming from an impressive staff of the most passionate fans and skilled writers ever assembled, all in one place. Check it out for yourselves, Mets fans. Go to MetsmerizedOnline.com right now. That's Mets, M-E-R-I-Z-E-D, online.com, and get Metsmerized today.
We're back. Final thoughts. Very interesting segment, I thought, with Eric Sherman. Went way longer than I expected. I usually have these guys on. So, give me 15, 20 minutes. I figured I'd do a nice little package show with a little feature. We'll talk about the Mets. The original plan was to record this after the final game of the road trip, and then I found out that Rich was looking for a co-host for the next couple of weeks. So I said, all right, well, Mets are playing late. Let's do this feature, do a little pre-final game of the road trip podcast, then you guys could hear me on 540 AM WLIE. You know, if you want to listen live, it's WLIE540AM.com. I'll be on from 8:30 to 10 p.m. I'll be co-hosting with Rich Catino. Last time it was just me. Rich was on the road in Washington covering the Mets. I will be co-hosting with Rich. Dennis Wozniak of the AP, who covers the Jets, will be joining us. We'll probably be talking some NFL draft, NBA playoffs, definitely get into the Mets, the Yankees, and do a little check-in here as we're about 25 games in or so at this point. So first, you know, we'll probably for next week do see what kind of segment I can do. But the end of every the month, you'd like to kind of do a check under the hood here and say, okay, where are these teams at? Where are the Mets at? So that's what I'll probably do. We'll do a little bit more extensive check-in next week. Mets will be home again. Be in the midst of our homestand, so we'll do that. But interesting stuff from Eric Sherman, and I'll leave everybody with this. I said a little bit about this during the broadcast. 88, that Dodger loss was horrific. I think it really turned the whole Davey Johnson era, where those final years, I wonder how things or how much patience they would have had if they had won the championship, which beating Oakland wouldn't have been tough. You know, just because the Dodgers beat them up doesn't mean the Mets would have. Let's remember that. Beating Oakland would certainly have been tough, but it would have been an interesting series. And it would be one that, you know, to this day, I think everybody would have liked to have an opportunity to see replayed or have an opportunity to see what would have happened. But for Davey to say that he doesn't regret, and I understand where he's going with Doc Gooden in that series. I understand that it's Doc, the numbers with Socia, the lack of power that Socia had. He's your ace. But if you look at the metrics, Doc already in 1988 was above league average pitcher, but he wasn't a dominant ace like he was. He was treating Doc in 1988 in that game four, which would have put him up 3-1, as 85 Doc when he wasn't. And at that point, you were progressive enough where you saw what Oakland was doing with Dennis Eckersley. You bring in your closer, bing, bang, boom. That was Randy Myers, lights out, game over. And who knows, maybe Myers spits the bit. You don't know, but that was the move, because if you're going to tell me that you have all the faith in the world in Doc in Game 4, then you should have started him in Game 7, not Darling, who already showed you 2 years earlier in Game 7 against the Red Sox that that kind of pressure, that kind of spotlight wasn't for him. And then Doc comes in the middle of that game, along with Aguilera, pitches pretty well, keeps them, you know, with 6-0 they lost. They weren't, listen, you probably weren't going to score a run off of Hershiser. Anybody who went up against Hershiser that day, it had to be a similar game to game one of the series where the Mets had to come back in the ninth, a little bloop hit by Gary Carter. It was a series where, against Hershiser, you had to match zeros. And Darling wasn't up to that task, not even close. And so I disagree. I think that when you had them down, knowing that Hershiser was who he was, the fact that you beat him in game one and you really put them the screws to them, forget about the David Cone, Bob Clappish ghostwritten column and all that, because David got clobbered in game two and then wound up pitching very well later in the series. They had to put the hammer down. They had to do that, and I disagree. I think Davey is sticking by his guns, and he's sticking with Doc, and he's doing what a good manager, I guess, should do, which is not waver in their decisions even 30-plus years later. But bad move. That was definitely almost 40 years later. 40 years, almost 30, 30, 40 years. 98, 2008, yeah. 30 years plus, 30 years later. It's been since the 1988 playoffs. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in. I hope you have a chance to check me out on WLIE 540 AM, WLIE540AM.com. I will also have it on this iTunes feed, RSS feed. You'll hear that later on. So if you don't want to tune in live, it'll be on this Talking Mets RSS feed, my co-host segment of the New York Sports Wrap on WLIE with Rich Catino. I want to thank Eric Sherman. You can check him out on Twitter, at Sherman Baseball. Eric Sherman Baseball's website. And the book is Davey Johnson, My Wild Ride in Baseball and Beyond. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Don't forget to check me out on iTunes, Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. Have a great Sunday. Enjoy the game, everybody. Take care.